gentlemen. Welcome to another edition of Warrior Connection. I'm Doug Rocky, and I'm on the radio tonight from this bright and sunny, and it's warming up here in Illinois. We finally got some sunshine. The rain has let up. We're still flooded out pretty substantially, but at least it's drying up. Well, we're going to continue on with the Progressive Radio Network moving forward and giving you education, information, ideas, and teaching you something as we go along. Tonight, we're going to continue with two more authors who have written very, very interesting books, and I've known both of them for some time, and we're going to discuss their books, how they got into writing and everything. But before we get to our first author, hopefully Denise Nichols, Major Denise Nichols, is on the air to give us an update on what's happened with veterans issues in Washington, D.C.
Okay. Hi, Doug.
Hi.
Nice to be on today. A couple of things going on is, number one, we finished our drive for getting sign-ons on the House side for the Gulf War Illness Research Program at DOD CDMRP. Now, what happens is the leaders that we have, which was Roe and Michelle up on the House, draft a letter, and it's sent out as a Dear Colleague letter. And this was basically to support our funding efforts at the DOD, Congressionally Directed Medical Research Program. There's like 25, I think, programs, not just Gulf War Illness, but other programs. So they had a two-week time period that we gathered supporters. Out of 435 reps, we only got 66 signed up. So we did better than we did last year, and we got significant people signed on, like the chair of the VA House Committee. So we got some influential people, but it just seems like we should have gotten more signed on, both Republican and Democrat. The Republicans were in the minority. Out of 66, we had 6 Republicans. So that's just not right, and we'll continue to work on it. We will be starting probably in June. We don't have the letter out on the Senate side, but we'll be starting the same process over there. As the letter goes out, we become notified, and we start working them on the Senate side, which is a lot easier for everybody to participate with, because everybody's got 2 senators. So how hard is that to make phone calls to 2 senators and email them and keep pressure on them until they sign on? The other thing is the June meeting of the VA RAC committee, VA RAC for Gulf War Illness Research. So if those of you that don't know about it, if you just Google up VA and then a space and RAC, then GWIRP, or just GWIR, I'll pull it up, you'll get the website with all their minutes, all the documentation, all the reports that have been put out. They will not be meeting in Boston. It's scheduled in June. And this is the first meeting they've had in person for over a year because of problems that were happening. So this one will be in D.C. in June. So any vets out there, any spouses, please mark your calendar. I think that we need to show support of the VA RAC committee that has been trying to work very hard against the roadblocks that we had at the VA. And hopefully by then we'll know if there's changes happening at the VA. Now, we do know that Chief of Staff Gimrich left. We do know that the head of research left. So there's some changes happening. The other thing to mention is that with the backlog, news came out this week that may have gotten lost in all the things about Boston, but they're going to try to give provisional-type claims and get some money rolling to people that truly need it. And that effort was, you know, an effort that came out of trying to problem solve and getting input from everybody, is they came up with this effort to, you know, kind of provisionally rate somebody and give a year for any changes to it. So there is an effort going on for that to help our veterans. I don't know what else they'll do. I know there was other suggestions made. So that's kind of the update from the Hill and from D.C. efforts for veterans. And next week, we hope to maybe have some call-ins. And we're going to talk, hopefully I'm going to line up one of the spouses that's interested in the care provider program that was initiated for the post 9/11, but not for the pre 9/11. And we have other veterans out there needing help with a caregiver. So we'll be starting an effort that she's already been investigating. So we'll have her hopefully on with me to discuss about that.
It's also, I think it's extremely important for all the veterans to know that Dr. Matthew Reinhardt and his staff up at the War Injuries Clinic in Washington, D.C. to continue to emphasize support for all the veterans in helping us. So, I mean, that's a really good effort, and we've been in contact with them, and Matthew has pledged to help the veterans, as you're totally aware, because you've been up here yourself.
And I know I've gotten feedback from the vets that have gone out to Palo Alto. I'm having some very positive feedback from them. And I have one of our first sergeants, I believe her rank was in the Army, that went out to Orange, New Jersey. So those three centers are up. Veterans, you need to use them. You go online to va.gov, and you will put in there about war-related illness centers. And it'll give you several pages of how you get referred and what it all means. So I tell people, go to va.gov, search around. There is some good stuff out there. We're not completely pleased with them, but, you know, we have to use those to the best ability. And, you know, the vets are going, and some of them are feeling much better after going through it. It does have to be coordinated when you get back to your VA after they refer you up there. They get a referral plan about what needs to be done. So, you know, there's some loose screws still in this plan, I guess. So I've had vets get back and then not get the follow-up they needed at their local VA, but they need to turn around and call back to the War-Related Illness Center and let them know or email them.
Yeah,
so there are efforts being...
The phone number for the War Injuries Clinic up there in Washington, and they'll get the help going, is 1-800-722-8340. Again, for the War Injuries Clinic in Washington, D.C., 1-800-722-8340. Well, thank you, Denise, and you have a good day. I maybe can stay a little with us. And right now, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to introduce another one of our fine authors, Tish Cook. Are you with us, Tish?
I am.
Well, welcome to Warrior Connection.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I've known you for a while, and I've read your first book, When You Speak My Name. I got an autographed copy here that I got from a previous author's fair.
Well, good. I'm glad.
That's a lot of fun. And the other thing, too, I just don't all of a sudden dawned on me. You and I both graduated from high school in 1967.
Oh, my. Well, now we're telling our age, aren't we?
Yeah, well, a lot more than that. Well, welcome to Warrior Connection.
Thank you.
Glad to have you. And again, you've got two books. I know, you know, the one book I've got here, When You Speak Your Name.
Right.
And then you've got your newest book that comes out, what, The Parrot in the Parlor?
Yes, The Parrot in the Parlor.
Wow. Well, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got into writing and discuss your books, please?
Well, I was born and raised in Springfield.
Hey, the home of Abraham Lincoln.
Yes. Yes. I went to Springfield High School, so graduated in 1967. I started working at the phone company in high school and stayed there for 32 years. 20 of those 32 years, I wrote training material.
That's pretty important.
And I was a trainer. So writing is not new to me. It's a lot of fun to write training material, but let me tell you, it's really different to write a novel.
Yeah. Your first book, When You Speak Your Name, that took place in multiple time frames, going back to the Civil War.
Yes, it did.
In Missouri, and then coming up to the present.
Yes.
And that took off because you have a great-grandma that was full Cherokee, correct?
Yeah, well, she was half.
Half Cherokee.
She was half Cherokee. And I was doing some genealogy research. Could not find her. I really had a difficult time. But as luck would have it, I did run across a few items. Finally discovered a little bit about my great-grandmother and what I learned that in 1863, she was born in 1852, died in 1936. So she was 11 years old, living in southern Missouri, Civil War was going on, Missouri was a hotbed of guerrilla activity, young men who just wanted to raise all kinds of havoc. And her father, my great-great-grandfather, was murdered by one of those young men. Once I found that out, I just felt like I had to write something about it. So I used my writing skills that I had as a course developer and a trainer and sat down and started writing, handwriting, first of all, and then found that I needed a typewriter. I needed something. So I got a laptop and just kept writing. It took about 2 years to put it together. But it was an extremely interesting story, and they did catch the young man, and he hung for that crime.
Yeah, it's a mystery story that takes place through over 100 years.
Right, right. You know, I didn't know any other way to tell that. I struggled with it because I wanted it to be a generational type of story where one life in one century touches another in another century. And I couldn't think of any other way to do it. And my niece, who is my editor, said, why don't you do parallel timelines? And so that's what that is. It's parallel timelines, jumping back and forth. But eventually those timelines do cross, as you well know. And, you know, the mystery is solved. So it turned out nice. I was really pleased with it. I hope that my great-grandmother is as pleased with it as I am.
Well, probably, because I can guarantee it's a good book, because I have read it and I've got it right in front of me.
Thank you. Thank you.
You know, it's always interesting to see this stuff and how it all parallels.
Yes.
Well, you've got your next book, the one that you're doing right now, or you finished, The Parrot in the Parlor.
The Parrot in
and
the Parlor.
The neat thing about this, and as I looked at this stuff, and I'll just read one blurb that you got here. The story began as a cozy mystery, but morphed somewhere along the way to be one of the personal struggle and redemption.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can't think of anything. I mean, that theme and the idea is what Warrior Connection is all about, because warriors have gone off to war. They've been involved in things. They're struggling with everything they have. They're trying to figure out, how do we get redemption for what I've been involved in,
right,
both good and bad, and how do we work it together? And here we got a new book. I mean, we've been finding out through this whole series, as we interview all the authors, we've had individuals with Korean War connection all the way through. We got individuals. We got an author coming on later that's an actual Air Force brat.
Oh, my.
Oh and doing my. Everything else. So tell us something about Parrot in the Parlor, and, you know, what is it and what's it about and why is it going to be so exciting? I haven't had a chance to read this yet.
No, you haven't. It hasn't been out that long.
Yeah.
Actually, The Parrot in the Parlor is a current modern day cozy mystery that, like I said, it started out as a cozy mystery. It stayed that way pretty much. But it involves, my main character is a man by the name of Angelo, and Angelo is a Michigan State trooper.
Well, look at about talking about applicability right now.
Right. So as a Michigan State trooper, he was looking forward to an entire career with the Michigan State Police, but unfortunately, you're going to find out that he has to retire. He's being forced to retire because he was shot in the line of duty.
Yeah, in other words, he's a disabled police officer.
Yes.
How many veterans out there have become disabled and hoping for entire careers, and
right,
now they have to change their careers? I mean,
right,
that's the common theme of what Warrior Connection is about.
Yes. And he has nightmares, obviously, about this whole event. And the nightmares continue, and they get worse. And he's lost all self-confidence because the one call that he took that he thought was no big deal ended up almost costing him his life.
Denise, are you still there? Okay, I guess she's gone, but our nurse was on the line, Denise Nichols, and I didn't know if she was there, because the whole concept, what you're learning, again, is the same thing that's happened to the veterans.
Right.
I mean, it's
right,
just a solid, solid theme that's come back and forth. Now, here we've got it in the, is this pretty much fiction, correct?
It is a novel. Yes, it is fiction. I use real locations like Grand Rapids, Michigan, a little town called Bitely, which is a real town in upper Michigan. And I try to use real locations within those towns, but it is fiction, yes.
So how does the story interrelate? I mean, you've got Angelo, who is a, you know, super Michigan State trooper, getting
right.
his whole career going, then all of a sudden, here the bad guys get him, he gets in a shootout, he becomes disabled.
Yep.
How does that affect his life and the story and what happens with him?
He's almost paralyzed because he just is afraid to make decisions. He's being
forced.
We have
a physical problem, and
yes.
then we have a psychological domain problem, too.
Yes. He lost part of a lung. He was shot in the upper torso and lost part of a lung. And as a result, you know, cannot fulfill his duties, did not want to take a desk job, so he took his early retirement. And he was forced, because he was shot in the line of duty, he had to undergo counseling. He did not want to do that. He didn't want to bare, you know, his soul. He didn't want to tell him anybody how afraid he was, or, you know, how concerned he was that he didn't think he was going to make the right decision again.
Boy, that fits all the time with all the veterans, because, you know, when we have to go, or the veteran, you know, I mean, they've got a problem, they ran into it, and the whole concept is, well, am I really man enough, or am I less of a man if I do decide to go for help?
Right. Right. But because, obviously, it was a mandate for him. He had to do it. It did help him. He did finally decide to open up a little bit, and then he started talking and was able to make some decisions on his own at one point, where he decided he didn't want to stay in Grand Rapids anymore. He wanted to move back to a small area in Upper Michigan where he was, as a kid, he would visit his grandparents who lived out there, and he just felt he needed to get away from all of that and just get some downtime. So he took his parrot, Callahan, and headed out to Bitely, Michigan, and made a decision to buy a big old Victorian mansion that was in need of repair. He thought, well, this will just keep me busy. He has lots of friends on the force who keep stopping by and helping him try to recover, you know, try to make those right decisions and encourage him to make those decisions. And so he wasn't out there all alone. You know, he had a support group, and he relied on them a lot to help him recover.
That sounds real important. I mean, what you're describing is exactly what the veterans need to do.
Yeah, I had no idea. When I started this, Angelo wasn't even wounded. You know, it didn't even start that way. And sometimes that happens. You know, you start a story, and then all of a sudden something takes you off in another direction, and then I have to come back and rework the story. So, you know, the beginning of this, the reader, it jumps right in to, you know, when he's shot and all the struggles that he goes through, and then trying to heal both physically and emotionally, and going back to a place where he felt comfortable, and, you know, was that going to help him, and meeting new people in that location, which that helped him also. And in the end, some good things happened. So I'll kind of leave it at that. I don't want to tell the whole story.
How did you? This is a fascinating book and totally applicable to Warrior Connection and all the veterans. And, you know, because we got out, and, you know, the whole thing in the story, and myself and all of us, you know, we could leap tall buildings at a single bound, you know,
yes.
four stories.
Yes.
Well, now after we got wounded and injured, well, we're down to, you know, maybe coming over a single story if we can even, in most cases,
yeah.
sometimes we can't even walk to the mailbox.
Yeah.
Do you have any experiences or something? How did you lead you into such an important book?
I don't know. It started out to be a story about a woman who was struggling to keep her antique store open, and a couple of sisters in their 30s who ride up on antique motorcycles, old vintage motorcycles, and offer to help. But there needed to be more, and I needed a police presence, because there were illegal things going on in this story also, and I needed a policeman. And I just thought, okay, I don't want a county cop. I want somebody, Michigan State Police. And so it just went from there. And then, well, how do I get him to Vitely? Well, there has to be a way to get him there. Well, maybe he was shot, you know. It's just one of those things where the mind just has to start rolling and jotting ideas down and then trying to figure out, will it work? And this one, this worked. I'm really pleased with this story. Not only the fact that, you know, I've never had anything like that happen to me. You know, I watch a lot of cop shows, but to have Angelo at one point being almost incapable of doing anything, to working through that. And, you know, all the cute little funny things that happen along the way. You know, and there's a romance here and some things that go on in his life. And his life does change. And he does begin to see that there is a light at the end of the tunnel.
You know, and that's one thing that's real important for the veterans. And I know myself and everybody, you know, God closes a door or a window here, but then he opens up something else. And, you know, when we start out a long time, I mean, this is our intent. This is what we want to do. And then life changes and makes decisions for us that,
yes. You
know, we have to adjust and come back together. And it sounds like in this case, you've written a book where he faced the ultimate nightmare of his job
as
a consequence, and all the health, the physiological and psychological consequences thereof.
Right.
And then what happens afterwards so he can... You know, all of a sudden the sun is shining bright again. Is that correct?
Yeah, pretty much. He finally makes a decision, and that decision proves to be a fruitful one. And the confidence is starting to come back. He just feels like, I guess I do still have it, you know. Just a real nice... A nice ending. It is an easy read. It is one of those books where you can sit down with a cup of coffee in front of the fireplace and finish it in about two and a half hours. And there's no graphic violence, you know, no graphic language. I don't do that in my books. But it's just a nice human interest type story with an antagonistic old battle axe named Bell who... stretches Angelo's patience to the limit. So,
I think we've all been there at least once in our life, if not more.
Yes, right.
I mean, I know, you know, when you speak your name, when I read that, that's one of those books where, well, you get starting and then all of a sudden you realize, well, wasn't I supposed to eat?
Oh, well, that's good. That, you know, that makes me feel good to know that, and people have told me that about When You Speak My Name, that it was an interesting book, and I didn't write that for any reason except I think my great grandmother was just insisting that I write it.
In other words, you had a reach out from the past into the future.
Yes, she was just. I could not stop writing it. It was one of those things where if I put the story down for a while, you know, in 2 or 3 days, there was something telling me get back there and start writing.
Well, you know, another part here in what you described, just knowing you from before and what you did, I mean, you're writing training materials, putting training development together for, you know, Bell Telephone, which became AT&T for, what, 30 years.
Right.
You know, so the veterans are coming out and they're looking for a job. And as you know, we've got the Troops to Teachers program and everything else. But teaching is not only in the schools. It can be within the corporate world, can't it?
Oh, yes. Oh, definitely. Corporate America, I think there's a lot of instruction that goes on. People don't realize how managers or people in large corporations have to have ongoing training because everything changes. Technology changes. Philosophies change. There's always training going on. We trained just hundreds of people, hundreds. So, yeah, it's out there.
Yeah, so, I mean, the veteran, because they're so used to doing training and development training materials and putting lesson plans together, especially if you're a non-commissioned officer or a company-grade officer, that's what your job is training in the military.
Yes, exactly.
So the parallel is exactly what you're doing. So, again, you know, some ideas here on what they can do, jump into this whole domain in corporate training. Which obviously, did you have any college work or college education for your train?
No. I went straight from high school to work for the phone company.
Hey, you know, that's real important. These kids are, you know, came out of high school and they did go there. So, you know, they can take it and capitalize it, can't they?
Oh, yeah. And, you know, work experience, life experience has a major impact on whether you get hired or not. You know, I was fortunate. We had an office occupations program. I was a senior in high school. I worked half days in the afternoons. I went to school in the morning. I had enough credits that I could graduate with participating in this program. And I started in senior year from 1 to 5. And the day after I graduated, I started full-time with the phone company.
Wow.
And I worked there for 32 years.
Oh, well, 1967, as you know, was kind of a unique year because,
yeah.
I mean, when you and I graduated from high school, for all the guys and all of us, we had a one-way ticket to Vietnam.
Yes, I know, and we,
you know,
lost
very,
you.
Yeah, yeah, just not possible, you know, unless you were an incredible athlete or an incredible scholar to get any type of, draft exemption.
Right, right. Yeah, my brother was fortunate in because he was in college, but, you know, we had kids who I graduated with who never made it home.
Yeah, there's a lot of us that have that stuff.
Yep, yep.
That's just part of life that goes on. But all of those experience and all of that stuff that we learn just ties together and make it so beautiful.
Yes, I just can't understand why someone who has that ability to train, that they can't just, you know, start knocking on doors and and submitting resumes. And especially the veterans, they have so much experience.
Yeah.
In learning and teaching. And there are places out there that need good instructors, need good teachers.
Besides the schools.
Yes, exactly. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Corporate America, there's all kinds of ways, I think, to instruct and bring your life skills and your life abilities to that corporation. Show them you're valuable, you know?
Yeah, it sounds like it. Well, you know, ladies and gentlemen, we keep telling you the Progressive Radio Network is moving forward and providing you education and opportunities. And, boy, we've just done it again tonight. I mean, it doesn't get much better. So your books are available on Amazon.com.
Yes, they are.
Sunny.com.
Yes.
Smashwords.com.
Yep.
Diesel.com, and also Barnes & Noble.
Yes, they are. Yes, they are. They can also, if they, and those are for e-readers, of course. If you wanted a paper copy of the book, I have a website, and you can order through that website, and that is tishcook.com.
So www.tishcook.com.
Yes, sir.
Well, your actual full name, is that a Cherokee name? Or?
No. Letitia? No, that is a variation of Letizia, which is Latin, which means joy. I guess I was my mother's joy.
Well, you know, that's a perfect lead-in. So you're your mother's joy, and that's what it is. And that leads us into our next author. And Kay, are you with us tonight?
I am.
Well, hey, Kay, welcome.
Thank you, Doug. Thanks for having me.
Well, Kay Neal and Tish Cook, I know both of you know each other, and you've been together and presented together. And the neat thing about this is, you know, as we're taking it, Tish has just taken the perfect transition where it was Latin for her mother's joy.
Yes, my ears picked right up when I heard that.
Yeah, and so, I mean, Tish, I know you met and you were there the other day.
Oh, yes.
And Kay's book is Teach Your Dog Latin.
Yes. Yes, I didn't get a chance to visit with you too much, Kay, because you were so busy. So.
Yes, I'm always running my mouth, talking to anybody who will listen to me say how wonderful Latin is for English-speaking people.
Well, Tish, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
Welcome to stay around or anything or come back. We'll have this up on the website. We'll people everything. And it was very, very, thank you very much, because your book tied in exactly in the Progressive Radio Network and Warrior Connection and what we need to do.
You're welcome. Anytime. Anytime. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, well, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, Kay, welcome.
Thank you so much, Doug.
Well, you know, as you and I have already discussed, you were raised as an Air Force brat, and you were at Chanute Air Force Base right here in Rantoul.
I sure was. When I was in seventh grade, that would have been in, goodness, I guess in the very late 60s. My dad was, that was his last duty station, Chanute Air Force Base.
That's something.
Yeah.
And then, also,
he was in Minot before. Sorry?
And then, as you and I have already discovered, again, for your life and everything, as your life progressed and everything, a whole bunch of us here, I know both Denise and I were on the command staff during Desert Storm, so we were over in Iraq, Saudi Arabia, and Kuwait putting it all together. And during Desert Storm, you were trying to put a life together and hold your life together in Lebanon, is that correct?
In Jordan.
Jordan.
Yes. Yeah, it was it was pretty freaky to be there. Some of my friends had left the country when it was obvious that you know, the area might be engulfed, and I didn't want to. I wanted to stay, but it was you felt very alive at that time because you didn't know if your life is. I mean, you know, we were not directly under attack. But we certainly felt that we could be caught in the crossfire. And, you know, nobody, I mean, it felt very, very unstable to be there. What I really remember from the time visually is all the windows being taped up with masking tape in case they shattered, that, you know, there wouldn't be such, maybe such dangerous shards going everywhere. And this went on for really for months, I guess. We had our, I think it was for months. It was at least for weeks. And the house seemed very light after we finally took the tape down. That's the visual that I have. But I do remember the fear. And we came back here to the States in 98. So, of course, things were, I mean, there was not a war imminent in our area by that time. But, yeah, it was, and I had a five-year-old and a one-year-old. So it was... I was just wondering what was going to happen if we, you know, where would we go to if anything got, you know, got hot.
Well, you can definitely understand the whole concept then of PTSD and the veterans and what the veterans are going through, because this was your life, not only when you grew up as an Air Force dependent, where your father was an officer.
No, he was an NCO, and he always says that if he was going to go back in the Air Force again, he would go right back in as an NCO. He said they can't run the Air Force without the NCOs because you know they're the ones out there on the very front lines, and he was very proud of that. Yeah, he worked on hound dog missiles. I remember that was what he did.
Well, he was
he's in
a missile
electronics.
Guy. Wow. Yeah, for those I know, well, Kay is totally aware of those aren't aware, and we talked about this because we've had the museum director on Warrior Connection before. You can go back to the archives for the Chanute Air Museum, Octave Chanute Aerospace Museum in Rantoul, Illinois. But that, for those in the Air Force and everybody, was the home of missile training. In fact, if you get to the museum, as Kay knows, there are still five missile silos into the museum that you can actually go in and take a look at. And then all of the hound dog and the SRAM training and all the air cruise missiles, that was done in the northern part of Grissom Hall. I think that's where your dad's classrooms were, probably.
Well, and, he was out. We lived on Circle Drive, which is now Andrews Drive, I think. And he was out. He was not in Grissom Hall. He was out in some kind of, it was a little bit remote. And I don't even know if it's north, south, east, west, but I think if you would drive from our house to his work, you could see the base hospital on the right, I think.
Okay, so he was out there in what we would call the southeast portion of the base. That was out there, and also the missile test cells and everything else.
That must have been where he was. I hope you won't be disappointed that I cannot give you any details because this was just kind of in the background for me. I never quizzed him about his work or was interested in it or thought there was anything strange about it and or remarkable about it. He was just my dad, and he came home at about 5:10 every night, and we had supper together. And that's how it was for me. But you know, I do, when you talk about post-traumatic stress, you know, I of course I have not been through anything like people who, you know, have seen combat, but I do remember being very worried about the communists, you know, when I was a kid. And I guess also, you know, living on base where you'd hear the fighters taking off for training all the time, it was so loud. We were right next to to the airfield, and I remember being very, very worried about that. I remember being very worried during the Vietnam War. It was a vague sort of, you know, I didn't know exactly what I was worried about, but I felt misapprehension and a lot of unease, you know, when I was growing up.
Yeah, so your book that you wrote, and I mean, I just got this from you the other night when we had the author's fair at Rantoul Public Library here in Rantoul, Illinois, Teach Your Dog Latin.
Yes.
I mean, you got this beautiful little puppy dog on the front cover in standing in front of a Roman column in a toga.
Yes, it's the best we could do on a toga. And his name is Ikey, and he lives between out in the country between Rantoul and Gifford. And he wasn't that eager to be dressed up in a toga, but we kept sort of begging him to, you know, please sit still for that photo, and then we'll take the thing off, and he can run around again. Yeah, the whole point of the book is to sort of, you know, disarm people from their fear of Latin or they're thinking that it's not approachable. And I you know, you don't even need to have a pet or a dog or, you know, any kind of a pet to enjoy Teach Your Dog Latin. It gives you an introduction to the language, to the, you know, vocabulary and the grammar. But it's a serious grammar book, but it is put in bite-sized, very manageable pieces that you could have a sense of accomplishment after you get through, you know, any part of any chapter and want more because you feel, wow, it's actually doable. I could see myself learning some more of this. So I hope that's what readers will get out of the book. I don't know if that's going to happen or not, but that was my hope when I wrote it.
Yeah, so, I mean, the book is actually a Latin primer to learn it then, huh?
It is. It definitely is. And it's, you know, of course, you need a lot of books and a lot of months to get through all the grammar of Latin, but, you know, every road starts with a, you know, with one, I mean, every journey starts with one step, and you, if you're afraid to set out on the journey, period, and you never take the first step, you can't see how the second and the third and the tenth and the 15th and the 150th steps could be done, but they can. I mean, no matter how difficult any subject is, you can learn it if you find somebody who knows the steps and if you're willing to go through the steps of learning it. If you keep on track until you get somewhere. And Latin is such a worthwhile thing to learn. It's, you know, 60% of English vocabulary comes from Latin, and 90% of English words that are more than two syllables come from Greek and Latin roots, and Greek and Latin have a lot of vocabulary overlap. And the vocabulary isn't even the best reason to study the language. It's the grammar. You know, you learn so much about English grammar when you study Latin. And my goal, or my hope, is to see Latin start showing up in elementary school as part of English. It's not necessary to want to be a Latin scholar or a classicist in order to have a little bit of Latin under your belt. It's such a worthwhile. I wish that every listener could have a chance to immerse themselves in just a little bit of Latin and see for themselves that it is such a worthwhile, enriching endeavor that they want more.
Yeah, so I mean, what you're describing basically, and I've known this for years for my academic education, for my good old high school years going into undergraduate and then the graduate program at the University of Illinois, but Latin is, as you just said, is the foundation for our language. And if you can learn the foundation...
Well, that is actually not the foundation for our language. We've actually borrowed a lot of vocabulary, and we've actually made some English grammar rules follow Latin patterns, which is kind of a silly thing to do, but we've done it. And one of the great things about studying Latin is that you start to find out where those patterns are, and then you can break these so-called rules with impunity. If anybody calls you on them, you can say, well, that's just an artificially imposed rule on English grammar. It doesn't make any sense at all. I'm not going to follow it. and nobody can say anything to you. But, you know, the languages that do come from Latin are the Romance languages, and that means the languages spoken by people speaking the language descended from the Romans, and that's starting from the West. That's Portuguese, Spanish, French, Italian, and Romanian. All those languages are modern-day dialects of Latin. They're completely based on Latin.
Wow. Again, this whole thing, because, you know, as a veteran comes out of the military, and, I mean, you grew up and have been in around the military your entire life.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole idea of you learned one thing, but you can take this step and you can learn something new. You can acquire new skills.
Oh, my goodness, yeah. That is really true. And I don't know that that is more true of anything than it is of Latin for an English speaker. There's so much of our, you know, if you study Latin grammar and then you read so-called difficult texts in English, like the texts that were written by people like Madison and Jefferson, texts that are considered very difficult, you can see the classical patterns in the sentences there, and you can understand them so much better. You can sort out these convoluted sentences with, you know, clause inside of clause inside of clause, and you, it just makes faster sense to you. You can be a much more efficient reader of difficult texts when you've got the Latin background. Yes, I'm so happy you said that, because it transferable is exactly what Latin is. I mean, it is so opposite of irrelevant and impractical. It's the most practical language I know for anyone who wants to improve their English.
Boy, that's pretty important, because if we're going to improve our whole life, we have to be able to read and to write. And so if we can improve that foundation and be able to read better and to write better, our whole life opens up for any job that we want to do or any endeavor we want to go to, doesn't it?
I think so. And you know, I'm really dismayed about all the emphasis, I mean, almost an exclusive emphasis on test scores. And teaching kids how to maneuver on standardized tests so that they can make the school or the teacher look better is just that doesn't get you an educated child at the end of the day. And if you would teach kids Latin, if you would learn it yourself, learn a little bit of it yourself, and I'm talking to, say, a teacher at this point, if you would learn a little bit yourself and work it into your English classroom, your child, your students would not require all these days and hours devoted to studying for standardized tests. They would have that content down, and all you'd have to do is teach them how to fill out a bubble form, or maybe a test-taking strategy like eliminating some answer that you know is wrong, or something like that. But that would all be very, very superficial. I mean, the real content that they would have would be enough to, you know, to get through any test. And I myself, I know this is true from my own experience. I had 3 years of Latin in high school. I actually came, in order to write Teacher Dog Latin, I came back to Latin the second time and got much better skills than what I walked away with the first time. But if you give me any test of verbal ability, I mean, you know, like the GRE or the ACT, any of the verbal tests like that, I'll never score less than 97th percentile, and I think that's pretty typical for anybody who you know, who's come out of a Latin program. Even if you don't do the whole 4 years, when you take the ACT and the SAT, you've only done 3 years anyway. But it is so it's so empowering, and then not to even have to study for a test like that, and know that you're going to get a top score on it, it's a wonderful feeling. Everybody should have it. it should be something standardized in our curriculum. And I'm trying to figure out how I can help make that come about. There's just so much resistance and so much hostility to Latin. It's so misunderstood. And classicists in general are not marketers, so people who are actually, you know, very far into the field are not really going out and representing the language, with the value that it could have for society at large. And I feel very isolated and lonely pushing this unpopular idea. But I can't stop myself, Doug. it's just the top of mind all the time. And I appreciate you giving me a chance to just go on and on about it.
Yeah, it's pretty neat. Well, I mean, you did your undergraduate degree in what, the classics, or what was it? What did you?
No,
study?
I did. Actually, I had a kind of a mishmash of an undergraduate first time around. I did it at the U of I, at the Urbana campus, and I had my degree actually says individual plans of study. I just had kind of cobbled together some stuff. I studied, you know, several different languages, but none at a very high level. And left university the first time feeling that I didn't really know much of anything. And I kind of wish they hadn't let me cobble that degree together like that. And I don't think they'd let you do it these days. But I found that I didn't really know how to do anything, and I ended up going back to school. I went down to University of Texas at Austin, where Bergstrom is located. We had been there when I was a kid, and I liked it. So I thought, well, I'll go to grad school in Bergstrom. And I applied to the MBA program there. And, you know, thanks to my Latin background and my fantastic verbal scores, and my math scores weren't that bad, although they certainly weren't anything like my verbal, I got into that school, which was a pretty hard school to get into, and did an MBA there, and then ended up being an editor when I lived in Jordan, and enjoyed that very much. It was a lot of fun to be given a red pen and a document, and people not only didn't get mad at you for marking up the page like my family did when I would mark up their letters and send them back, they actually gave me money and gave me another document and told me to go do it again. And so I liked that a lot. And all the years that I was editing and just living and raising our children, I had in mind that I wanted to come back to Latin at some point. I had this, even though it defeated me on my way out of high school, I had a lot of respect for it, a lot of affection for it, and I knew I was going to come back someday. And I did that about 10 years ago. I decided, okay, the time is right. I'm going to come back to Latin. I'm going to get myself a textbook, and I'm going to learn it. And I'm going to learn Latin to the point that when I read a text, I am going to have the same sensations wash over me that would have washed over a Roman. You know, I'm going to laugh at the funny parts. I'm going to gasp at the shocking parts. I'm going to cry at the moving parts. And I'm just going to know the language that well. And, of course, I did not get to that point. That's still, you know, off in the future. But it's a good goal. You know, I have really high standards. I never really meet my standards. But at least I have high standards. And what happened to me was, as I started going back and studying Latin again, and of course I started at square one because I didn't remember anything. It had been, 30 years, 25 years. And I started studying, and then I realized that it just hit me that it was such a shame that kids couldn't have access to this. As a matter of course, you know, you had to go to a very fancy school, or you had to have some relative or somebody who knew the language who would be willing to teach it to you. And I got the idea that every kid in the country ought to have a crack at this. And I thought, you know what, the schools are probably not going to, I'd already figured out that the schools would be pretty hostile to this. And I thought, you know, I'll just go straight to parents, and particularly mothers, and I will write a curriculum that any normal person could use to learn Latin in manageable stages and teach it to their children along the way. And I started doing that, but I didn't know much Latin myself. And what happened was I ended up going back to school at the University of Illinois again, and I got a second degree in classics, a bachelor's degree, and then I also did a second master's degree in Latin, and I got that in 2009 from the University of Illinois.
Well, you know,
and
anybody that's been able to go through the University of Illinois at all and get any type of a degree, that's an extraordinary school, and to have multiple.
Well, you know, I don't think they should have given me a degree the first time around. I think that what I knew didn't deserve it. But I tell you what, by the time I got out of that master's program, I thought, they couldn't have wrung any more effort out of me. I remember one class, a graduate class I was taking in Plautus, who is a second century BC comic writer. And he's somebody who has a lot of stock characters, just like you see on situation comedies these days. Those came out of Plautus and another playwright, Terrence. And I forgot where I was going with this, Doug. I'm just so happy to be talking about Latin that I can't keep track of my thoughts. Oh yes, in the I was talking about how hard grad school was when we took a course on Plautus. And at the end of the course, one of the classmates said, and it was very grueling. We had far more assigned to us than we could even begin to do, but we had to do it. We had to figure out somehow how to do it. And at the end of the course, one student said, now that I've taken a course on Plautus, I feel qualified to take a course on Plautus. And I thought, oh, my goodness, we all did. I thought, yes, now we feel prepared. We could actually understand this course if we took it again. But, of course, you don't get to take courses twice, which is really a pity because I know from my own experience with Latin that the first time around is not necessarily the best time. You need to see that material again. You need to start from the very beginning. If you're having any confusion at all, you just go back to the beginning. And when you see it a second time, a lot of things crystallize that were very, it just seemed inaccessible before. And then the second time around, it starts to somehow gel in your brain and some kind of process that I don't understand, but it's almost magic.
You know, it sounds like the whole key thing again, I mean, you've had an incredible career and an incredible life. I mean, just staggering. But the whole thing is if an individual wants to achieve a goal or an objective, especially the military coming out, and you're a perfect example because, you've been in the military your entire career at one point or another, in one aspect or another. All it is taking that first step and taking that second step and getting the academic education and putting out the effort to get it achieved, and you can achieve anything.
That's true. That's really true. And it is so sad that this kind of thing, I mean, for instance, goal setting. I mean, what is, you know, really for a human being, what's more important than knowing how to set a goal and work towards a goal? And you never find any course in a school that is about goal setting. I mean, I think that's a missing piece of the curriculum. I think there's a lot missing in the curriculum, and there's a lot of time wasted on things that don't matter. And yeah, it is a real pity that that you don't have that in you know as a normal course of education. It's kind of a tragedy.
So what I mean, when I picked up your book and you told me what your book was, I mean, teach your dog Latin. I mean, the first thing that just kind of struck me is, what's happening here?
Well, that's good, Doug, because that means I threw you off guard and you didn't have a chance to get defensive. that's part of my strategy.
Well, that is really neat. How can people, I mean, this is your first, how many books have you written? Is this your first book or have you got other books?
This is my second one, but my first book, it takes me, how much time have we got? Because it takes me at least 2 or 3 minutes to explain what it is. I'll tell you super briefly. It is a reference book for confused Latin students. So it's for people who have been in Latin for a little while, but now the stuff is starting to swim together in their head, and they can't keep things straight. And a Latin word at the back of it, at the end of it, has got quite a lot of information in it, and it tells you how it's interacting with the words around it. And the endings are a particular ending. Like IS, for instance, might be used to mean a lot of different things. And so my first book, which is called Endings and Middles, lets you know what your options are. But that is something that you wouldn't want unless you were a more advanced Latin student who started to get confused. But Teacher Dog Latin, I put it on Amazon. I don't have it available as a Kindle edition. I kept meaning to do that, but I've never gotten around to it. And but you can go to Amazon and it's a very easy title to remember, Teach Your Dog Latin, and you'll find it there.
So it's on. You can obtain your book then, Teach Your Dog Latin by Kay Neal. It's on Amazon.com, And this is published by Prelim Press also.
Prelim Press. Yeah, that's my little outfit that I figured out how to set up. And so that's me, and I actually fulfill the order. So if somebody orders it, it will be me putting it in an envelope. And if somebody wants to order it and they would like it signed, they could just mention that in the, you know, there's a place for instructions when you order a book on Amazon, and you could just put in the instructions, you know, sign this book to so-and-so, and you know, tell me something about the person, and I'll come up with some appropriate signing for the book.
Yeah, so this is www.prelimpress, P-R-E-L-U-M, press, P-R-E-S-S.com.
Well, that's, I have my endings and middles available there. I never bothered to put, in fact, I was actually looking at my website, Prelim Press, and I thought, you know, there is a page for Teacher Dog Latin, and I thought I should actually make that active with an order form, but I didn't yet, but it is available on Amazon. Yeah. If you just go to Amazon and type in Teacher Dog Latin, I'll come up.
That's excellent. Well, Kay, I'd like to thank you very, very much. I mean, this is enjoyable. It's something different again. I mean, ladies and gentlemen.
Yes, different.
Warrior Connection,
I'm always a different person.
Yeah, we're opening the doors all over on education and knowledge and information and how you can achieve. And as we've learned tonight, you can take those steps and go forward and do anything that you want to do. But it's just a matter of making a decision to take the step and ask for help, isn't it?
It sure is. It sure is. And just do it. Get up every day and do it again.
Well, anything you can close in. I mean, you grew up as an Air Force brat. You went on, continued on, connected with the military and all through your entire life. Are there any hints or suggestions that you've learned as a child and the spouse of, you know, a military officer that you could give to all of our listeners and the other spouses?
Well, oh wow, gosh, I'm drawing a blank. You know what, Doug? It's funny that you would say this because when I first got married to my husband, who was he's Jordanian, and you know, there was quite an adjustment period. We lived in Jordan, and there was quite an adjustment period for me, and things were very rough for the first few years. And finally, one day, it hit me. I thought, you know, he's Arab and I'm American, that's what the problem is. And then it finally hit me. No, he's military and I'm civilian. And I think I'm actually more in tune with military, you know, military, like, you know, dedication and perseverance and just a sense of beauty and getting the job done, keeping at it till it's done. I developed that late in life, actually, even though I had all these really good examples around me. But, you know, I guess the message is don't give up hope.
Yeah. Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you, Kay. Thank you, Tish. God bless America, and let's keep going. We've learned how to do it tonight, and take it easy. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and have a good evening.